This program is intended for print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Audio Journal's reading of Yankee Magazine. You'll hear stories about the people and places that make New England special. Mountains, farmland, salty seacoasts, history, sports teams, universities, cultural attractions, food, and more. This is Charlene, and I'll be reading from the March-April issue of Yankee Magazine. Thank you for joining me, and a big shout out to Naomi for reading episodes 1 and 2. Along with the Yankee Magazine, I'll also be reading some articles from Down East, if time allows, another great resource for fun and facts in New England. Conversations with Joseph Lee. A Wampanoag writer explores the complexities of indigenous identity, displacement, and resilience on Martha's Vineyard and beyond. Interview by Joe Cajon. Illustration by Zia Gordon. Joseph Lee's story is a quintessentially American story in that it stubbornly defies an easy definition of what a quintessentially American story even is. He grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, the son of a civil engineer and a preschool teacher. His parental grandparents were Chinese. His maternal grandmother was Japanese, and his grandfather was Wampanoag with a mixed background. As a boy, Lee would spend his summers on Martha's Vineyard, up island, with the Akina Wampanoag, a people who have lived on the island for some 10,000 years, unbeknownst to the average tourist. Many people don't fully understand that there are indigenous people in this country, Lee says, and they certainly don't think of them in the Northeast, and then they definitely don't think of them in a place like Martha's Vineyard. Lee's experience of visiting Akina every summer, staying with his grandparents, attending tribal summer camp, planted the seeds of a complicated but no less profound connection with his Wampanoag heritage, which he grapples with in his book, Nothing More of This Land, Community, Power, and the Search for Indigenous Identity, published last summer. A mix of memoir and reporting, the book covers Lee's favorite and formative summers with his tribe, his drift away from that part of his heritage, and finally his efforts to forge a more progressive, inclusive understanding of what it means to be indigenous. He spoke with us from his home in New York City, where he works as a freelance writer and journalist. Yankee, you grew up in the suburbs of Boston, but you always went to Martha's Vineyard in the summer when you were young. What do you remember from those days? My earliest memories on the vineyard would be going down there and visiting my grandparents' house in Akina. They had this old house with all these old books and artifacts, and the house had an interesting layout, with a sort of semi-hidden staircase. It was one of those houses where, as a kid, you can really lean into your imagination. But it was also summer, so I remember spending time running around with my brother and tribal cousins, going to the beach, getting ice cream cones, hanging out, playing outside. Yankee, it sounds pretty idyllic. In many ways, it was perfect. Yankee, going to tribal summer camp on the vineyard, which ended up being a formative experience for you, what did that look like? Some of it was like a normal American summer camp. We'd do arts and crafts, go play tag outside, eat some popsicles. But there would be days where we would spend a little more time learning the Wampanoag language, or we'd do something more tribally themed. We'd go walk in the woods and learn about some of the plants, and we'd make moccasins. Yankee, what was it like to connect with your Wampanoag heritage as a kid from the city suburbs? It was mixed. On the one hand, I really valued it because I knew it was special and I knew it was something important and unique and I wanted to learn more. I wanted to care about it. On the other hand, we were kids. We just wanted to go outside and play. It's summer. I don't want to be in here learning the language. Yankee, you write, too, about staging a big tribal show every summer for a non-Wampanoag audience. We'd all dress up in traditional regalia and act out what we call the Legends of Mashup. It's the story of our ancient legendary leader, Mashup. He was a giant, and he led us to Martha's Vineyard, created the island for us, and created all these various landmarks on the island. When I was really young, it was just one of those things that we did. But as I got older, I started to think about it. Like, wait a minute, is it weird performing this thing for outsiders? What is the message that we're telling these people? I began to wonder if it was confirming some stereotypes for people in the audience, because we were dressed up in the traditional outfits. We were talking about historical events. Were we drawing enough of the line between the past and the present to understand that this is a modern tribe? We're still here, where we've evolved. Yankee, one thing you grapple with in the book is reconciling your Wampanoag heritage with the various other strands of your ancestry. Talk to me a bit about your family's history. The tribe has been on the island for over 10,000 years, well before written records. We can trace the family tree back through the generations. But what really interested me is that I had always assumed, and this is where even I fall victim to stereotype, that being Indigenous through history means you stayed in one place. I thought my family must have always stayed here, which of course makes no sense. People move around, and especially on an island. They're seafaring people. My mother was born in Japan, but grew up on and around Martha's Vineyard and was always coming and going. My grandfather was born in Akina and then left and sailed around the world. His father was a lighthouse keeper, famously in what was then Gay Head. Yankee. He was the first Wampanoag lighthouse keeper on the island. Right. But before that, he worked at other lighthouses because that's where the work was. So he left. Going back through the family tree, there were always people leaving Martha's Vineyard, but then always coming back or always maintaining a connection. That was really important for me to learn as I tried to figure out my relationship with this place and how can I navigate being attached and being connected without leaving here. Yankee, there was a great deal of mixing in your family too. Your father's family is Chinese. Your mother had a Japanese mother and a Wampanoag father with a mixed background. That's another really interesting part. I had told myself really simply version of colonial stories in which we were here and then some white people came from Europe and then it was bad. But it's a lot more complicated than that. My mom's last name and my middle name is Vanderhoop, which is a really big family in the tribe today. I thought that name probably dated back to 1620 or something like that, but it was from the 1800s. My great-great-great-grandfather, William Vanderhoop, was a mixed heritage person coming from the Dutch colony of Suriname who ended up meeting a Wampanoag woman in New Bedford, and they came back to Martha's Vineyard. There are all these kinds of twists and turns and interesting wrinkles in the history that I think really complicate the way we think about Indigenous identity and tradition and ancestry. Yankee, that sort of diversity is part of the reason you reject a blood quantum, the idea that someone needs to be a certain percentage of Indigenous ancestry to be considered part of a tribe. Instead, you argue that the most important thing is choosing to engage with that part of your heritage and the way in which you engage. But is there a point where someone has so little Wampanoag blood that they are seen as insufficiently indigenous? It's not to say that anybody could just choose to be Wampanoag. You have to have some sort of family connection. But then it's up to you how much of that is going to be a part of your life. For our tribe, there's no blood quantum at all. It's just a lineal descent. And what's interesting about that is we don't really know for sure how much Wampanoag blood that people even had back through the generations. They could have been intermarrying, intermixing. We don't really know. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm skeptical of those sorts of pseudo-scientific ways of understanding identity. It's the same way that I think about Indigenous culture. There's always this returning to tradition, going back to the past thing. But what traditions are we talking about? If we're talking about Wampanoag tradition 400 years ago, it's going to be different from Wampanoag traditions of 500 years ago. It's a constant evolution. Yankee, in the book, your family's history, your history, and the tribe's history all come together in the form of your family's shop, Hatmarcha Gifts on the Cliffs of Akina. You worked there as a teenager, and similar to the performances at tribal summer camp, you were putting yourself out there answering questions from customers about the Wampanoag people. Outside the store, it wouldn't have occurred to people to ask you why you weren't dressed like a Wampanoag, but in that place, behind the counter, you became an exotic. Yeah, and what's ironic about it is that in many cases, I'm the one bringing it to their attention. They're coming in, they're just trying to buy a t-shirt on Martha's Vineyard, or a mug, or a hat, or something, and I'm there telling them, well, hey, you are on Wampanoag land, and all these shops are owned by Wampanoag families. And then that's what sparks these weird questions. People would just straight up ask, aren't all the Indians dead? What are you still doing here? You don't look really Indian. Do you live in a real house? Why are you wearing those clothes? One really specific one that I always laugh about is somebody asked, do you use iPhones? Yankee, do you chalk any of that up to the naivete or curiosity from people who have had no exposure to this culture whatsoever? I would say with the majority of people, it's coming from a place of earnestness. They're genuinely interested and they want to learn more, but they lack the tools and the vocabulary to ask better questions. And of course, there are people who are less well-intentioned, but for the most part, people aren't trying to be offensive. Yankee, how would you describe the Wampanoag people's relationship to the vineyard's tourism industry? It's really, really complicated. For Wampanoag people, tourism-adjacent injuries are one of the main ways to make a living, whether it's having a store up at the cliffs, working down island in a restaurant, renting your home, working in landscaping, working on a charter fishing boat. All of these things are connected to this massive tourism machine. But on the other hand, it is an increasing invasion every summer, and it's driving up the cost of living. It's making it increasingly difficult for Wampanoag people to stay on Martha's Vineyard. Yankee, talk about your personal journey as you explored your Wampanoag identity. You engaged with that part of yourself as a kid, and then as you got older, it started to fade. As we talked about, I grew up spending a lot of time on the island in the summer. But as I got older, in high school, I was on sports teams, so I would spend only part of the summer and go back for soccer preseason. Then I started getting jobs and internships and eventually went off to college in New York. It was this big part of my life, and then it was slowly getting less and less, which isn't to say I wanted it to be less. There was more stuff in my life that left less space and time to be on the island and have that tribal connection. There are times where I wondered, is it going to slowly decrease unless I make the decision to move back there? Yankee, what inspired you to reengage? After college, I went to grad school for creative writing. I did an MFA degree, and I started writing about the tribe and my experiences in the tribe. I think that was my way of trying to tackle these questions I had about what it means to be Wampanoag and how our community works. I was really trying to unpack that, but it was also my way of figuring out a way for me to have the life I had in New York while still remaining connected to the island. Yankee, it's an interesting point because there is the idea that tribal membership is inextricably linked to the land. It wasn't really an option for you to move to the island, but it did sort of force you to come up with a more complex connection with the Wampanoag identity. Indigenous identity is inextricably linked to the land, but that's not the only part of it. Writing about that allowed me to develop other ways of connecting. It was about finding deeper things to think about beyond my own lived experience. I started trying to learn more about the island. By this point, my grandparents had passed away, and I asked my mom about them. I'd try to dig up old records, I would read old newspaper clippings online, watch old videos, and try to learn as much as I could. That led me on this path to becoming a writer and becoming a journalist. And then from there, I developed so many more questions of things I wanted to learn, things I was trying to figure out. Suddenly, I'm talking to Native people, Indigenous people from other tribes, from all across the country, and realizing that a lot of the questions that I have, these other people have too. And a lot of our issues are shared issues. That really broadened my understanding of, okay, the thing that I want to do, which is engage with the tribe and try to understand the tribe, I can do in a way that's not just being there and going to summer camp. Yankee, what's the state of the Akina Wampanoag today? Right now, we have over 1,000 members in the tribe, but most of those do not live on Martha's Vineyard. And even of the ones that live on the island, a lot of them don't live in Akina anymore. So we're a dispersed people. What does it mean to be such a dispersed community? Dysphoria is not a word that tends to get used often with Indigenous communities, but I think it should. The state of Martha's Vineyard is another challenge. There's a housing crisis on the island for everybody, but I would say it's especially acute for Wampanoag folks. You can track the Wampanoag land holdings there, and they get less and less every year. Yankee, and even if a Wampanoag family owns land, they still have to pay the taxes. Sometimes people make this mistake. It's like, oh, Indians get all these free benefits. They don't pay taxes. We're definitely paying taxes and feeling it every year. It just becomes really, really hard to hold on to the land. And it's also hard to just live on the island. Opportunity is limited. Housing is limited. People leave for education. There's no college on Martha's Vineyard. All of these things contribute to Wampanoag folks not living on the island. Yankee, what are some good things happening right now with the tribe? There's a lot of exciting stuff happening. There's a lot of hope and optimism. There are new projects happening all the time in education, in our language revitalization. We have the Cultural Center, which is our museum in Akina, but it's also a cultural hub, and they've been doing these cultural nights on Fridays. Yankee, what do you want visitors to Martha's Vineyard and New Englanders in general to take from your book and from the broader history of the tribe? At a basic level, I would really like for people to know that the Wampanoag people still exist. We're still here. We're real. We're still fighting for our land and our rights to protect who we are as a community. Beyond that, I think it would be nice for people to engage more with the tribe and listen to the tribe and think about the ways they could support the tribe. In a place like Massachusetts, there is a lot of interest in wanting to do the right thing. Colonialism is bad. We want to honor the tribe. But people need to push past that and think in terms of specifics and think practically. And I think a lot of that is asking those questions, learning, and coming more prepared to the conversation. Yankee, maybe it starts with people realizing that you guys have iPhones. Wouldn't that be nice? I mean, somebody could give us a bunch of iPhones. We're not opposed to different forms of reparations, whether it's an iPhone or a little bit of land back. And you can read more of Joseph Lee's story in his book, Nothing More of This Land, Community, Power, and the Search for Indigenous Identity. Next story, Down East Rising, how an audacious little rocket company could make coastal Maine an unexpected front runner in the commercial space race. By Brian Kevin. On a quiet summer morning on the downeast coast in the year 2040, a distant rumble causes a pair of lobstermen to look up from the traps they're repairing. It's a Sunday when hauling is prohibited in Maine waters, and the local rocket company tends to schedule its launches. Ambling to the edge of the dock, the two gaze offshore, squinting at a distant platform silhouetted against the horizon. As they watch, swigging their coffees, a slim rocket begins to ascend, trailing a light gray plume, a silver needle stitching a pale thread into the sky. The rumble lasts less than 30 seconds, and once the rocket is out of sight, the lobstermen turn back to their traps. They've seen this before, a couple of launches a month these days, up from two or three a year, back when the rocket company first opened its mission control near the harbor master's office. They know the rocket will ascend some 250 miles to about the same altitude as the old International Space Station, but that it won't reach the velocity needed to stay in orbit, falling instead back to Earth after 7 or 8 minutes in space. And they know that companies and research entities pay a pretty penny to access those minutes in microgravity, that the rocket is ferrying sophisticated experiments that MIT or Intel or Pfizer delivered to their little corner of New England, ready to be installed in a payload bay and remotely initiated when the craft reaches zero G. And that exhaust trail dissipating over the ocean, they don't worry anymore about its effects on marine life or on their livelihoods. They watch the rocket company's founder nibble on a chunk of its proprietary biofuel a few years back during a presentation at the new fabrication shop. They've both done some off-season work there, welding rocket parts, not to mention hiring on occasionally to help retrieve rockets after a splashdown. In fact, in just a few short years, the town's whole little aerospace sector has come to feel pretty humdrum, just another scrappy enterprise in a fishing town used to scrappy enterprises. That's Sasha Derry's vision for the future of Blue Shift Aerospace, the rocket company he founded in 2014 and currently operates out of a former naval air base in Brunswick, Maine. And at times during the past couple of years, that vision has felt tantalizingly close. For example, early one evening in October 2024, when Blue Shift gathered a few dozen investors, reporters, and space industry muckety-mucks on a stretch of the base's tarmac to witness a crucial rocket test. During the hours before ignition, Derry had mostly sat inside the 2006 Timber Lodge travel trailer his team had retrofitted into Mission Control, running diagnostics and narrating excitedly on a live stream. But now and again, he stepped outside to mingle and chat with the small crowd, an affably earnest 50-something in khakis and a Patagonia vest. With his salt-and-pepper hair and black-rimmed glasses, he looked like a slightly crunchy Ira Glass, a far cry from space entrepreneur stereotypes of strutting startup bros and bombastic showmen. As dusk settled in, Derry grinned and joked about needing to get the test off before his daughter's bedtime. Though his commute wasn't far, his home just down the road in the little coastal college town. But back inside the trailer at the moment of ignition, Derry felt tense, his eyes glued to a cinder block bunker a quarter mile away as a spear of white flame erupted from one end of it. Inside was a makeshift combustion chamber, a huge cylinder of inch-thick steel more commonly used as sewer line pipe. Alongside the bunker was a vertical tank 30 feet tall and gleaming from which oxidized flowed into the combustion chamber at a hopefully steady pace. Jerry took his eyes off the fiery plume only long enough to glance at a screen full of data, monitoring, among other things, pressure, thrust, and all-important duration. The test of the engine he named Marvel, the modular, adaptable rocket engine for vehicle launch, was what was known as a full-duration hot-fire test. It was Blue Shift's second and would determine how well Marvel could handle a full 60-second burn of the company's top-secret biofuel. That's how long a rocket would need to reach the Karma line, the boundary between Earth's atmosphere and space, some 62 miles above the main coast. 30 seconds in, the screen told Derry that the engine was delivering more than 16,000 pounds of thrust, a bit less than was needed to get Blue Shift's envisioned 50-foot rocket, dubbed Starless Rogue, into suborbital space. It's 8 times more than what propelled a 20-foot prototype called Stardust some 4,000 feet into the air in January of 2021. That low-altitude launch from the frozen runway of the former Loring Air Force Base in far northern Aroostook County was Maine's first-ever commercial rocket flight and the world's first powered by non-toxic, nearly carbon-neutral biofuel. That, too, had been a moment when the vision of an eventual Maine spaceport had felt very close. But suddenly, 55 seconds into the burn, the smooth white-orange plume was interrupted by a shower of fiery debris, accompanied by a sound like a burst of radio static. To the spectators outside, it looked like sparks pinging around the tarmac. Inside the trailer, a chorus of voices called out, "E-stop, E-stop," which is emergency stop. Derry leaped from his seat and charged into the control room, his far future vision abruptly replaced by a more immediate one of catastrophic combustion chamber failure, an explosion that could set the project back months and put those cinder block walls to the test. The first spacecraft Sashi Derry ever sketched was a Viper attack ship from Battlestar Galactica, which enthralled him as a 70s kid with precious little access to TV. He was 6 years old when his parents took the family back to the land, moving to a cabin in East Orland, Maine, near where homesteading gurus Helen and Scott Nearing had famously farmed since the 1950s. At first, Derry's family lived off the grid, but the simple life proved grueling. When they succumbed to electricity, Derry spent much rationed TV time escaping to the worlds of Battlestar, Buck Rogers, and Doctor Who on a black-and-white TV set. The outdoors was his chief entertainment, the woods where he wandered unsupervised, Toddy Pond, where he and his brother paddled and sailed. His dad forbade motorized boats. On winter nights, he nestled into snowbanks at the water's edge to look up at the Milky Way. That's where I remembered asking my dad what was up there, how many people, how many stars, Derry says. All those normal kid questions, or what used to be normal kid questions. His family moved 12 more times before he turned 18, all within Maine. Like we were running from the law, he jokes. And all throughout, Derry kept asking questions about the stars. He was still in East Orland when he made his first rocket, an aluminum tube stuffed with match heads. He was in Brunswick on his way to a high school biology class when the Challenger exploded in 1986. He left Maine to major in physics at Indiana's Earlham College, a small school founded by Quakers, his mom's faith tradition, where he studied, among other things, quantum mechanics and the expansion of the universe. Then, after graduation, Derry's interest swerved. He picked up a second bachelor's degree in electrical engineering at the University of Southern Maine. In 1999, he co-founded a solar power startup in Boxborough, Massachusetts, and the company was a success, helping DIY customers install at-home solar as that market was heating up. But Derry still felt the pull of the stars, and in 2011, turning 40, he also started feeling something like a midlife crisis. I decided, embarrassingly, that I was going to give up playing video games at night and dedicate my spare time to something I really wanted to do before I die, he says. The goal he settled on, launching a space probe to Proxima Centauri, Earth's next closest star system, some 4.25 light years away. It's an ambition so improbable that when NASA briefly considered it in the 1980s, the agency dubbed the concept Project Longshot. An object traveling at 1% the speed of life, which no human man-made spacecraft has yet achieved, would reach Proxima Centauri in roughly 425 years. But Derry nonetheless began pouring his spare time into reading textbooks and papers on aerospace tech, propulsion physics, material science, fuel chemistry. He turned his office into a make-do lab and machine shop, complete with a CNC mill for crafting engine parts. Using an online meetup platform, he assembled a ragtag crew of big-dreaming collaborators with whom he brainstormed and tinkered. On his brother's farm in North Yarmouth, Maine, he started testing amateur-sized rockets. That's where he was in 2013 when he had an epiphany. Derry had already narrowed his interest to what are known as hybrid propellant rockets, in which a solid fuel source is injected with a liquid oxidizer to help it burn. Hybrid rockets are simpler, cheaper to build, and safer to transport than engines relying solely on solid fuel, like NASA's space shuttle boosters, or liquid, like Elon Musk's SpaceX uses. But the particulars of the fuel and oxidizer mix can vary. One day, in his brother's farmhouse kitchen, Derry's eye landed on a certain substance in a container on the windowsill, and he found himself wondering how it might behave as fuel. To hear him tell it today, the mystery substance outperformed petroleum. He won't say what his proprietary plant-based fuel source is, but it is avowedly non-toxic and nearly carbon neutral. Derry has declared that it can be cheaply sourced from farms across America. A University of Maine researcher once placed it in a tank full of seawater alongside a live lobster, harmlessly, for 2 weeks. In 2022, during a CNN interview, Derry held up a crumbly black bar of it and took a good-sized bite. He incorporated Blue Shift in 2014, and as he launched into 3 years of fuel testing, along with fundraising, team building, and early development of what would become the Marvel engine, Derry's lofty focus on Proxima Centauri faded. In its place, a new vision, a fleet of eco-friendly rockets carrying satellites and research payloads, launching from the down east coast and bringing the booming commercial space industry to Maine. And the prospect of rural, far-flung Maine as a conduit to the stars strikes you as unlikely, don't tell Emily Dwinnels. As one of the chief architects of the Maine Space Corporation, a public-private entity established by the state in 2022, she too envisions the day when the Pine Tree State is a launch pad, and not only for Blue Shift, but also for a host of rocketeers. A Kittery-based consultant in the tech and data sectors, Dwinnels prepared a report for the state legislature that laid out the surprising number of assets Maine has going for it as a would-be space hub. One of the biggies, all that little developed coastline, like Cape Canaveral in Florida or the Gulf Coast Peninsula that hosts SpaceX's Starbase. Maine's sparsely populated down east coasts allows for launch trajectories over the Atlantic, minimizing risk to populated areas and permitting recovery at sea. What's more, a rocket launched from the down east coast can head south over open ocean, which provides a clear pathway for a spacecraft to establish a polar orbit. That's a perk that few other U.S. launch sites offer, and a huge plus for many commercial satellite applications. Imaging, communications, climate monitoring. Since satellites travel pole to pole, can pass over any swath of the globe as it rotates west to east below. An added bonus, Maine's rural character makes it an ideal place to download satellite data with minimal electromagnetic interference. No surprise, then, that launch sites are one of three core business units the state legislature tasked the Maine Space Corporation with developing. Speaking to a room full of aerospace professionals at the most recent Maine Space Conference in Portland, Executive Director Terry Shihada said he envisioned the corporation at some point buying or leasing coastal property for construction of a spaceport. Though the legislature dictated these be only for small rockets, not NASA-scale launches causing noise, traffic, shockwaves, and debris. "We're not interested in becoming the Cape Canaveral of the North," he said, speaking on a panel alongside an exec from Florida's Aerospace Development Agency. The other two pillars of the nascent Maine Space Complex include an analytics center offering specialized tools for processing satellite data, along with a campus where space startups and established operators can share industry-specific tech and other resources. So far, only that last component has a head of steam. In 2016, Derry moved Blue Shift from his office in Massachusetts to Brunswick's former Naval Air Station, decommissioned in 2011, and since reborn as Brunswick Landing, a sprawling mixed-use development. It's now also home to the Maine Space Corporation, which last year opened an innovative hub full of shared tech and is actively wooing more space-related ventures. In the past 3 years, Blue Shift has been joined there by another small rocket startup, Proman Aerospace, a Ukraine-based company that has yet to launch, and an office of Teledyne Technologies, a $5.5 billion tech giant that built components for NASA's James Webb Space Telescope. In 2023, after touring Blue Shift in Brunswick Landing with a delegation of Maine politicos, NASA's highest-ranking official touted Maine's brilliant future in space. "You bring up space and everyone thinks of it as something Florida does," Dwindles said. "So part of the communications piece of this is just making it believable for Maine. And that means emphasizing the extent of the opportunity. The nonprofit Space Foundation valued the 2024 global commercial space industry at $480 billion and predicted rapid growth within a decade. Much of that value is tied to products and services that rely on orbiting satellites, often quite little ones known as nanosatellites that do things like track your Uber Eats delivery, feed data to your weather app, and put images into your Google Maps search, along with plenty of more esoteric applications. Some of it is tied to the sector that Blue Shift is targeting: companies, universities, and government entities that need short stints in microgravity for research and development. Want to learn how to make computer chips without gravity-induced defects? Or culture cells more effectively for drug development? Suborbital rockets, while not powerful enough to deploy satellites, can facilitate these and other remotely conducted experiments in micro-G. But in recent years, folks looking to get to space for any of these purposes have encountered a problem: not enough rockets. There are wait lists to send a payload up on a big launch from, say, NASA or SpaceX, and paying passengers on those rockets can't be choosy about the specifics of their trajectories or schedules. So Blue Shift is far from alone in trying to bring alternatives to market. In fact, Derry has built the company during what Douglas Gorman, a reporter for the space trade publication Payload, characterizes as a global startup boom within the small rocket sector. And likewise, Maine isn't the only state hoping to build infrastructure to woo those startups and the space-bound clients they serve. But I think Maine is approaching it in a unique way that has some staying power, says Gorman, a native Mainer, as it happens, now based in New York. It's because of the geographical aspect, the ability to have a spaceport, but also because it's doing things like converting old military facilities to support the space industry in other ways. For all the talk about the future, however, Dwindles cautions that would-be commercial space clients won't stay underserved forever. We have a time-bound opportunity here, she says. You look in the paper, and every day there's a new piece of news about space. Maine's launch window, in other words, is now. Blue Shift's first stab at a 60-second engine test hit a snag at T-minus two whole days. A full-duration hot-fire test is a milestone in a rocket's development. The first cautious test of the Marvel engine had lasted just 5 seconds. The next ran for 20. Tripling that, burning through the fuel load required to reach space, subjects an engine to far more stress. The hiccup was a lack of nitrous oxide, the liquid that's injected during a burn, into a hollow cylinder of the trade secret biofuel. For weeks, the Blue Shift crew, these days about a dozen strong, had been readying a shiny new oxidizer tank the size of a small silo. Custom built by a Rockland manufacturer, there's that space economy trickling down. The tank is flight ready, meant to ascend as part of a finished rocket. But there was a learning curve to filling it for the first time, transferring N2O from an array of small pressurized cylinders, and days before the scheduled test, the team realized they were short of the 400 gallons needed. Their usual supplier said getting more would take weeks, weeks of payroll and busy work, with the site already prepped and the test already trumpeted to investors and the press. We were ready to drive around New England and literally load whatever we could find in the back of my F-250, Derry says. This is not how SpaceX rolls, but to hear Derry and his teams tell it, Yankee ingenuity, a willingness to improvise and work on the cheap, sets Blue Shift apart as much as its biofuel. That F-250? During engine tests, that is, when it's not towing the mission control RV, it's parked near the bunker with a pallet tank full of water and a pump, an old-school backup for the test site's firefighting carbon dioxide quench system. Inside the bunker, meanwhile, a huge length of commercial steel pipe serve as a cheap testing alternative to a fully engineered combustion chamber. Something I enjoy about watching our engineers work is an emphasis on producibility and testing that's so real-world, said David Hyrikian, Blue Shift's chief technology officer. If you sent our designs to engineers at other companies I've worked for, you'd get a big piece of metal and a five-axis milling machine, and you'd machine all this complicated geometry, and it'd cost $150,000. Our crew starts with, let's buy a sewer pipe. Hyrikian, a Boston University mechanical engineering grad, has been with Derry since the beginning, having answered his online call for would-be rocket scientists back in Boxborough. I walked into that room looking for people who wanted to build something, he remembers. Sasha mentioned the Proxima Centauri idea, and I was like, this is batshit. This dude is lighting rockets on a farm. But the thing about Sasha, he said, is that he thinks it's possible. He's able to imagine these abstract ideas, and he sounds wild when he talks about them sometimes, but then he is also super down to execute. After a few desperate calls to main gas suppliers Blue Shift executed its first full-duration test after only a week's delay. It was largely a success, the Marvel engine delivering high thrust for over a minute, along with some evidence of instabilities midway through, a slight sputtering to the plume as it blasted out the back of the sewer pipe. Having an issue to address seemed almost to bolster Derry all the more. "This was incredible," he told 1,000 or so viewers of his live stream. "I can't wait to hear the results of the data and make the next test even better." The next test, the one in October 2024, was indeed better, the flurry of shouts for an emergency stop notwithstanding. The engine, it turned out, burned through the last of its fuel right at the minute mark, T plus 60 seconds as designed, stopping itself by the time anyone got a hand on the big red button. The sparks that Derry and others saw were the result of burning through a cardboard liner surrounding the fuel, and although a simple graphite piece was expelled from the chamber, it caused no damage. Nothing supposed to fly out of the motor, but this was great because it was an informative and benign failure, and preventing it gave us a metric for our next test. And while the e-stop episode briefly terrified Derry, you'd never have known it from the smile he wore as he bounced out of the RV to join press and investors on the tarmac. Derry is a winning communicator, and as the last moments of twilight gave way to darkness, he stood in front of the testing site and relayed Blue Shift's whole genesis story, the farm, the windowsill, with an eager, almost theatrical flair you might expect from a fanboy's Battlestar Galactica episode recap. When he finished, one of the TV news people muttered about the darkness, switched on an LED, and asked Derry to repeat his whole spiel. "Oh, sure," Derry said, unfazed. And then he did, without any noticeable lapse in enthusiasm, as if the words were leaving his mouth for the very first time. That knack for storytelling may serve Derry the next time he sets out to garner support for launching Blue Shift rockets from Maine. He has twice tried and failed to win backing for such a plan in Washington County, at Maine's salty eastern edge, a region not known for its embrace of the new. In 2021, Derry approached the town council in Jonesport, population 1,300-ish, some 50 miles east of the pond where he once stargazed. A landowner there was willing to lease a small, uninhabited island as a launch site. Derry vowed no more than 32 launches a year, all on Sundays when lobstermen cannot haul, or in the evenings when the fishing fleet is in. He pitched STEM projects with local schools. He stressed how dramatically smaller the rockets and launches would be compared to the SpaceX ones on TV. He said he aimed to build a manufacturing facility, hiring welders and machinists, drawing on the town's boat-building workforce. But locals worried about effects on fishing, and when the town responded with a temporary moratorium on aerospace operations, Blue Shift instead set its sight on nearby Steuben, re-envisioning launches not far from land but from a self-elevating barge called a lift boat. Initially, Steuben's council was supportive, but local opposition stressed the threat of pollution and made comparisons to SpaceX's impacts on the Texas Gulf Coast. Elon Musk's gargantuan company has been fined there for discharging industrial wastewater into sensitive wetlands. Its exploding spacecraft have rained debris, and last year saw more than 150 launches of its Falcon 9 rockets, each of which, experts say, releases some 336 metric tons of CO2 into the atmosphere, roughly equal to the carbon output of 78 cars driven in a single year. In March 2025, Steubenites approved a referendum prohibiting both commercial rocket launches and space industry manufacturing. Derry was disappointed by the setback, but at the moment, he and Blue Shift have more pressing tasks. Among them, an investment round, obtaining an FAA commercial launch license, further perfecting the oxidizer injection system, and building a flight-ready combustion chamber and fuselage for the rocket they're calling Starless Rogue. The goal, if these and other pieces line up, is a launch of Starless Rogue with paying customer payloads from New Mexico Spaceport America before the end of this year. Lately, DERI has also been focused on fielding other interests in Blue Shift's engine tech, including for use in boosters on hypersonic jets. A bit ironically, he says, it isn't the carbon-neutral nature of his fuel that's attracting the interest, but instead that it's simply easier to source, store, and transport than the toxic chemicals found in conventional solid rocket boosters. It also doesn't hurt that it's less expensive, too. But while he doesn't yet know where, the dream of building a coastal Maine launch facility is still at the core of DERI's long-term vision. And he repeated as much for the local news folks out on the tarmac in Brunswick. What ultimately motivates me, he said confidently, is that Maine can have a real foothold in exploring space and the universe. Then he seemed to go off script for a moment. And I'm hoping that, he said, then paused. This is not, he tried again before faltering. The beginning for me was 11 years ago, DERI said finally. Then he gestured behind him at the darkened test site beneath the first faint stars. But this feels just like the beginning. Here in New England, Mel Allen, a best place. Finding a home means so much more than just owning a house. From the day I arrived in New England during a January 1970 snowstorm to now, I have lived in 18 different houses in 11 towns, 7 in Maine and 4 in New Hampshire, the state I've called home since the autumn of 1979. I have been part of many stories telling of deep roots and love of land, the words always belonging to others. Most of those pieces have appeared in this magazine, which for 90 years has been devoted to a singular sense of place. This feeling of belonging is elusive and cannot simply be wished for. It cannot suddenly be grafted on. For the nearly half century I worked at Yankee, my deepest roots were planted in an office with a view of the town fire station and a grassy meadow that climbed slightly to a knoll beside a country road. Most of the time when I left, it was on the edge of night. When the pandemic hit, for many months, there was no separation between work and home. Town became a family we all shared, and then it ended. I have a friend who has lived most of his life within a few miles of where he was born and raised. Even when he explored living elsewhere, he knew he would return. His house nestles against a forest. Summer days pass in a family boathouse handed down through the generations on one of the prettiest lakes in New England. If my friend were a tree, his branches would spread high and wide. People would rest beneath its shade and look up in wonder. My wife, Annie, grew up in the same small town where we are now settled in an old house by the river. She has lived in Rome, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., but years ago, she too came back to her birthplace. And since I moved here, I have realized that where I see buildings and shops and streets, she sees history, traditions, stories. And mostly she remembers. When we are walking in town and people pass by in cars or on foot, she knows many by name and what they do and often what their parents did too. A small town genealogy that only those with long ties to a town will know. There is time now to be attentive to the comings and goings of the people who share this place with me, to listen to the rhythm of a town. I had never thought of it this way, but it is not unlike nurturing any relationship. A 5-minute stroll from our house, there is a local grocery store with a few tight aisles. When I enter, as I do almost every day, one staff member or another greets me by name. Not long ago, a young woman who works there had made cookies and offered them hot from the oven to me and other customers. Recently, I stopped in to find the store celebrating the birthday of a man who had grown up in town and who had worked there for years. Decorated cupcakes and cookies lined a counter, and we were coaxed to help ourselves. You could hear the shouts of "Happy Birthday, Dwight," carry all through the store. When I walk through town now, people call out and nearly always ask how I am liking retirement. Many of them know this stage of life. When we have walked a bit of a distance, I ask Annie their name, and she knows. Next time, I will know it too. I have lived in our town for 17 years, and only now, because I am here, daybreak to dark, I greet the people tending the flowers on Main Street. I am learning the names of the dogs we pass by each morning. Maybe, just maybe, I can have more than a house by a river. If I try, if I am patient, I can also find my own best place, a hometown. Mel Allen is editor-at-large for Yankee and the author of Here in New England, Unforgettable Stories of People, Places, and Memories That Connect Us All. Earth, Sky, and Water, LLC, 2025. This reading of Yankee Magazine has been a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Charlene, and thank you for listening.
Audio Journal presents a fundraising event Sunday, April 19th, 2026, 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the College of the Holy Cross, Worcester. This year's event is Castaways and Coconuts, a parody based on Gilligan's Island, a two-act, one-hour radio show featuring the radioactive theater players of Audio Journal. Seating will be theater style. There will also be a cash bar, live instrumental music, raffle prizes, and a live auction. Once again, that's Castaways and Coconuts, Sunday, April 19th, 2026 at Holy Cross College, 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. For tickets and information, please go to www.audiojournal.org/castaways or call us at 508-797-1117.
This is BirdNote. I'm Jonice Franklin, BirdNote's content director. One thing we love to hear at BirdNote is when educators and parents are able to use the show as a teaching tool, like BirdNote listener Kim Bradman.
One thing I like about BirdNote is the length, short little bites. I even use it in the kindergarten classroom. When I have a really nice coloring sheet that they can watercolor paint of a bird, I'll play a BirdNote of that bird. You get some little factoid that kids and adults both enjoy.
After listening to BirdNote with her kids, Kim has seen their bird knowledge and her own begin to grow.
I just see them noticing more. We'll try to name the birds outside the window at the feeder, and we're trying to learn the calls a little bit more. It's kind of a way to both appreciate the birds, but also see the growth in yourself.
Her son Ben is adding more bird calls to his repertoire.
I can imitate a mourning dove. I just like birds. I like everything about them.
BirdNote has helped you learn more about the birds around you. So support the show with a donation at birdnote.org.
For BirdNote, this is Ben Bradman.
And I'm Kim Bradman. BirdNote is the bridge between generations of conservationists.
If you love birds like I do, I hope you'll make a donation to BirdNote today.
Support this work at birdnote.org.
Listen to Audio Journal on your smart speaker. Just say, "Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or, hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn.